Marie Antoinette's story is one of spectacular transformation, from a teenage Austrian archduchess to the most controversial queen in French history. What makes her tale particularly fascinating is how she wielded fashion not merely as personal adornment, but as a political weapon. While most royals before her had used clothing to reinforce tradition, Marie Antoinette broke the mold, turning her wardrobe into a battleground for autonomy and power. Her sartorial choices became so influential that Sofia Coppola's 2006 film adaptation featured Converse sneakers among the period costumes, a nod to the queen's rebellious spirit that resonates with modern audiences. Caroline Weber's meticulous research reveals how Marie Antoinette's fashion statements weren't just frivolous indulgences, but calculated political maneuvers in a court where appearance was everything, and a queen's body belonged not to herself, but to the nation. When 14-year-old Marie Antoinette crossed the Rhine in May 1770 to marry the future Louis XVI, she underwent a profound ceremonial transformation that marked her transition from Austrian to French identity. On a small island between kingdoms, she participated in a formal protocol requiring her to relinquish all possessions from her homeland, including her clothing, jewelry, and even her cherished companion, her pug, Mops. This deeply affecting moment caused the young princess to shed tears for the first time since departing Vienna. Following this ceremonial transition, Marie Antoinette emerged transformed according to French royal standards, her hair freshly styled with powder, her face painted in the court fashion, adorned in an exquisite cloth of gold gown with diamond-adorned shoes. The symbolism was clear. She now represented French royal interests. As rain penetrated the pavilion's roof, she found brief levity in her lady's disheveled appearances before facing another emotional farewell to her Austrian attendants who had cared for her since childhood. In Strasbourg, she embraced her new identity by choosing to speak only French, winning public admiration with her gracious demeanor. The tapestries she observed upon arrival, depicting Jason and Medea, a foreign princess who utilized appearance to navigate power, would prove prophetic of her own journey. Like Medea, Marie Antoinette would learn to use court fashion as a means of adaptation, though her story would take a more dramatic turn. At Versailles, the challenges persisted. Her wedding attire presented complications, with noticeable fitting issues during the ceremony. The traditional wedding night protocols proved equally challenging, as court custom required numerous attendants for the formal bedding ceremony. The ritual culminated with both bride and groom expected to receive distinguished guests, including the Archbishop, Louis XV, nobility, and foreign dignitaries. While the Dauphin appeared stoic, Marie Antoinette found the public nature of these ceremonies deeply unsettling. These ceremonial proceedings established the fundamental tension that would define Marie Antoinette's reign. While her public image belonged to France, she would spend the next 23 years attempting to assert her individual identity through the very conventions intended to define her role. Versailles was no ordinary palace, but a magnificent political machine designed by Louis XIV to keep nobility under his watchful eye. Housing between 2,000 and 4,000 inhabitants and accommodating up to 10,000 people daily, it transformed mundane tasks into sacred rites and prestigious duties for which aristocrats fiercely competed. In this elaborate system, clothing externalized both royal power and each courtier's precise place in the hierarchy. As one nobleman observed, courtiers in France were even more the slaves of fashion than of the prince. Despite being constantly surrounded by people, Marie Antoinette experienced profound loneliness at Versailles. Unlike her carefree days with siblings in Vienna, she now lived under constant observation by an enormous entourage, from her dame d'honneur, Madame de Noailles, and 12 noble women companions to 16 women of the bedchamber, femme rouge, 100 household officers, 200 servants, and numerous other staff members. This rigid system of etiquette transformed her into both an idol and a victim, worshipped like a goddess but robbed of all privacy. even at bath time, despite wearing a long cotton gown into the tub to preserve her excessive sense of modesty, she couldn't escape her retinue's avid stares. Her body, as her mother had warned, was decidedly not her own. The dressing ritual was particularly excruciating. Custom dictated, the Dauphine could reach for nothing herself. Her dame d'honneur poured water for hand washing and passed her chemise, while her dame d'atours presented her underskirt and dress. If a princess of the blood arrived, the entire choreography would restart according to rank, often leaving Marie Antoinette standing naked and shivering for extended periods. When she finally erupted during one particularly cold morning, exclaiming, "Oh, this is odious! What an inconvenience!" her outburst spread through the palace, further damaging her precarious position. Given her continued failure to conceive or gain her husband's affection, such disruptions to the ceremonial display of her station provided additional ammunition to her critics. The young Dauphine's marriage remained unconsummated for 7 years, despite Maria Theresa's insistence that everything depends on the wife and that Marie Antoinette must be compliant, sweet, and amusing toward her husband. The Dauphin's childish behavior continued even in his evening routine, where instead of visiting his wife, he spent nights in his own rooms engaging in bizarre antics like trying to loop his Order of the Holy Spirit sash through attendants' earrings and tugging painfully when successful. In this suffocating environment, Marie Antoinette sought freedom through the one element she could control, her appearance, though even this would prove a double-edged sword. In October 1770, Marie Antoinette made two significant advances, resuming the whalebone corset, and graduating from riding donkeys to horses. During the court's fall visit to Fontainebleau, she followed the hunt in her caleche, receiving special attention from Louis XV. Emboldened, she sought permission to ride horseback. Despite Mercy's warnings about the aunts, Marie Antoinette asked Madame Adelaide for help securing the king's permission to ride. Though Adelaide had faced similar objections in her youth, she didn't share this with the Dauphine, instead presenting the request to Louis XV in a way that initially vexed him. To everyone's surprise, the king granted Marie Antoinette's wish. 3 days before her 15th birthday, she had her first riding lesson with a stable boy leading her horse. Aristocrats flocked to witness the event and reported her great joy. The king was so charmed that he immediately allocated 24,000 livres for her hunting mounts, and she soon became a fixture at his side during royal hunts. Marie Antoinette's taste for freedom manifested in a striking change of dress that repudiated conventional expectations. Though she retained the required corset under her riding habit, the justaucorps, her rebellion was more radical. She abandoned the long flowing skirts of side saddle riders for slim breeches and a straddled mount, like a man. In the French court context, riding astride in breeches carried powerful connotations of masculine royal authority. Since medieval times, the ideal leader was imagined as a chivalrous warrior king. Louis XIV had perfected this strategy, using hunting to showcase his courage and authority. As historian Philip Mansell noted, royal hunts symbolized royal mastery over humans as well as animals, serving as shorthand for monarchical power. Louis XIV wasn't the only sovereign to use equestrian dress as a political statement. After overthrowing her husband to become Empress of Russia in 1762, Catherine the Great appeared at her first military review astride a horse, wearing a male officer's uniform and a feathered tricorn hat. This masculine appearance reminded her troops and subjects that she was perfectly capable of doing a man's job. Ironically, it was Marie Antoinette's mother, known to her subjects as King Maria Theresa, who most strongly advised against her daughter's cross-dressing habits. Informed by Mercy about the Dauphine's cavalcades, the Empress warned that riding would spoil her complexion and waistline. More critically, she cautioned that riding like a man, dressed as a man, was dangerous, as well as bad for bearing children, and that is what you have been called upon to do. That will be the measure of your success. What Maria Teresa failed to grasp was that her daughter's passion for hunting represented an effort to achieve an alternative measure of success at court, one unrelated to the procreative functions traditionally assigned to a Bourbon wife. Unable to assert authority through the womanly channels of pregnancy and motherhood, Marie Antoinette leveraged her illustrious lineage, which connected her to Louis XIV and the Imperial Caesars. In summer 1771, Marie Antoinette commissioned a portrait of herself in masculine-style riding garb, despite her mother's request for a painting depicting her in your finery, not in a man's clothing. Though this canvas has been lost, similar portraits survive. In one pastel by Joseph Kranzinger from late 1771, the Dauphine appears from the waist up in an androgynous red justicorps, the hunting uniform at Trianon, yellow kidskin riding gloves, and a three-cornered hat edged with gold braid. Even more striking was a later equestrian portrait by Louis Augustine Brun, showing Marie Antoinette's full body as she rode to hounds. Attired in a blue habit with masculine breeches, a lace cravat, high yellow boots, and a feathered hat, she sits confidently astride a horse in a bold, rearing stance. Both the horse's position and the rider's masterful air deliberately echo the great equestrian depictions of Louis XIV, an extremely bold move for a princess whose position remained precarious. For Louis Auguste's coronation in June 1775, Reims Cathedral transformed into a Baroque spectacle. The new Louis XVI, kneeling in cloth of silver, received Charlemagne's ancient symbols of power, while 12 princes in ermine and gold surrounded him. Yet beneath the audience's jubilation, the young king was heard gasping, "The crown is hurting me." Meanwhile, 19-year-old Marie Antoinette watched from a special grandstand, dressed not in timeless ceremonial garb, but in contemporary fashion, a sapphire-laden gown by Rose Burton, so heavy it required special transport. Most striking was her towering powdered hairstyle topped with white feathers, making her face appear merely the midpoint between coiffure and hem. When Louis XV died of smallpox in May 1774, Marie Antoinette appeared poised for influence. The young Louis XVI promptly exiled both Du Barry and her supporter Daguillon, seemingly a victory for the queen. But the aunts quickly arranged a private meeting with their nephew, convincing him to select ministers from the anti-Austrian French party. Despite growing closer to her husband, she discovered he had no intention of involving her in state affairs. "When I reproach him for not having spoken to me on certain subjects," she later confided to her brother, "he looks somewhat embarrassed. Political affairs are those over which I have the least control." Isolated politically, Marie Antoinette turned to clothing and spectacle to boost her standing. At her Renaissance-themed extravaganzas, she appeared as Gabrielle d'Estrées, Henri IV's powerful mistress, while convincing Louis XVI to dress as Henri IV. Though her choice to pose as a royal paramour seemed incongruous given her childless marriage, the outfit's extravagance implied she enjoyed the spending power of a royal favorite. As she later confided to her brother, "Without ostentation or lies, I allow the public to believe I have more credit with the king than I do in reality, because if people didn't believe me on this point, I would have less power still." Her strategy worked. Courtiers commented on her apparent dominion over the king and nobles, and even Maurepas's ministers showed her increased deference based on her perceived influence. In October 1773, Rose Burton, an unmarried 24-year-old from Picardy, defied guild laws by establishing her shop, the Grand Mogul, on Rue Saint-Honoré. Her boutique resembled an aristocrat's salon, gilded moldings, full-length mirrors, fine paintings, and displayed complete ensembles covered in luxurious trimmings. Despite her portly build and ruddy face, Burton impressed visitors as a, quote, "great personage in petticoats who never suffered contradiction, presiding over elegant shopgirls with supreme authority." In early 1774, Burton introduced the pouffe, a revolutionary headdress built on scaffolding of wire, cloth, gauze, horsehair, and teased hair. Created with hairdresser Monsieur Leonard, these elaborate constructions featured miniature still lifes expressing feelings, pouf au sentiment, or commemorating events, pouf à la circonstance, transforming women's appearance into personalized mobile billboards. Marie Antoinette's poufs cleverly combined fashion with political messaging. Her coiffure à l'Epigénie featured black mourning ribbons, a black veil, and a crescent moon, paying tribute to Gluck's opera Epigénie en Allude. The opera had debuted successfully weeks before Louis XV's death, thanks to Marie Antoinette's support of Gluck, her childhood music tutor from Vienna. She had crushed opposition from Madame du Barry by attending opening night with her husband and leading vigorous applause. Another politically charged creation was the pouf à l'inoculation, which she unveiled after convincing Louis XVI to undergo smallpox inoculation, a practice common in Austria but controversial in France. After weathering fierce criticism for imposing this foreign custom on her husband, Marie Antoinette celebrated his successful inoculation with a gigantic pouf featuring Aesculapius's serpent twined around an olive tree symbolizing wisdom, with a golden sun representing Louis XIV's returned glory, though whether through Louis XVI or his consort remained ambiguous. After ascending to the throne in 1774, Louis XVI gifted Marie Antoinette the Petit Trianon, a small neoclassical chateau near Versailles, originally commissioned for Madame de Pompadour and later used by Madame du Barry. This exquisite villa became the queen's personal sanctuary away from court life. "You are fond of flowers," Louis reportedly told her, "so I give you this whole bouquet." Marie Antoinette immediately embraced the chateau's delicate, light-hearted sensibility, which contrasted sharply with Versailles' imposing grandeur. Marie Antoinette's reinvention of the Petit Trianon drew on the established tradition of the pastoral, the cult of the simple life, which had long influenced French courtly culture. While Jean-Jacques Rousseau's writings linked luxury to socioeconomic inequality, giving them revolutionary political significance, they also inspired a vogue for rustic simplicity that appealed to the Queen's aversion to Versailles' stifling protocol. Marie Antoinette replaced the rigidly geometrical landscaping of André Le Nôtre with an English garden inspired by Rousseau's novel Julie, or The New Héloïse. Following Rousseau's prescription for gardens without order and without symmetry that appeared charming but uncultivated and wild, she created rolling meadows, meandering rivers, and casual plantings of trees, shrubs, and flowers. The Petit Trianon quickly emerged as a symbol of Marie Antoinette's ascendancy over Louis XVI. Like the private residences of royal favorites Pompadour and Du Barry before her, the Queen's palace represented an extension and assertion of her unusual power. She marked her dominion by affixing her personal cipher to the wrought iron staircase and library books, and requiring staff to wear distinctive scarlet and silver livery different from the white, blue, and red of the king's household. Most strikingly, all regulations at Trianon were issued by order of the Queen, an unprecedented feminization of monarchical decree that symbolically transformed even Louis XVI into just another of her subjects. Paradoxically, the Queen's move towards simplified living enhanced her royal power. While Versailles granted noblemen varying degrees of royal access based on rank, Trianon required a personal invitation from the Queen. Unlike the public palace, the Petit Trianon was locked and guarded against unwanted visitors. By withdrawing from constant public scrutiny, Marie Antoinette took control of her image, challenging expectations that the Queen should be perpetually available for viewing. At Trianon, Marie Antoinette adopted a fashion style matching the villa's cultivated simplicity. Following Rousseau's prescription of simple apparel as an antidote to overwrought Parisian costumes, she embraced natural beauty over artifice. The Queen didn't abandon puffs entirely, but adapted them to Trianon's pastoral aesthetic with garlands of roses, flowers, and even actual baskets of fresh blooms. Marie Antoinette's radically transformed court fashion by introducing simpler silhouettes that defied traditional aristocratic dress codes. She convinced Louis XVI to allow smaller panniers and shorter trains for court functions, while at Trianon, she introduced even more revolutionary styles. The robe à la Polonaise eliminated restrictive panniers and trains, replacing them with a small bustle and jaunty swags that exposed the wearer's ankles for easier movement through Trianon's fields. The levite, a loose-fitting gown inspired by classical theater costumes, eliminated whalebone bodices and featured a simple belted waist and relaxed sleeves, making up over a third of the queen's wardrobe by 1782. Marie Antoinette's Trianon wardrobe rejected the ostentatious fabrics and colors that traditionally broadcast aristocratic status. Instead of the weighty brocades, lush velvets, and bright jewel tones favored by nobility, she embraced bourgeois, grays, beiges, and subtle pastels. She expanded her fabric repertoire beyond rich silks to include printed cottons, like Toiles de Jouy, with miniature landscapes echoing Trianon's gardens. Gauze, muslin, and linen became fashionable, often in simple white. By 1780, one of her favorite ensembles was the gulle, a white muslin shift copied from colonial Caribbean wear, worn over a flexible cloth bodice instead of whalebone stays, accessorized with a ribbon sash, sometimes an apron, and always unpowdered loose hair. Between 1783 and 1787, Marie Antoinette oversaw the construction of her famous Hame, a picturesque half-timbered country village near the Petit Trianon. Here, the royal family could gamble among perfumed flocks of sheep and cows, feed birds in the dovecote, eat freshly picked fruits, and drink milk from Sèvres porcelain cups reportedly molded on the queen's own breasts. 2 years after the Vigée-Lebrun portrait scandal, Marie Antoinette's controversial goal played a pivotal role in the diamond necklace affair, a scandal that arrived just as the French public was learning about both the woeful state of the national economy and the shocking extent of the Queen's clothing expenditures. The affair would damage her already tarnished reputation beyond repair and drastically compromise the monarchy's stature, with a white gull serving as the sartorial smoking gun that set events in motion. In August 1784, Cardinal de Rohan, dressed in his scarlet vestments under a black cloak, met what he believed was Marie Antoinette in the moonlit grove of Venus at Versailles. The figure, dressed in the queen's signature white gull with ribbon sash, straw hat, and blonde hair, gave him a rose before disappearing. This brief encounter convinced Rohan that the queen, who had snubbed him for 9 years, was finally extending her favor. The meeting had been orchestrated by his lover, the Comtesse de La Motte Valois, who claimed to have brokered a relationship between Rohan and the queen, who supposedly needed someone to perform secret services hidden from Louis XVI. Following the encounter, La Motte explained to Rohan that Marie Antoinette desperately wanted a 2,800-carat diamond necklace called the Slave's Collar, originally designed for Madame du Barry. Priced at 1.6 million livres and unable to purchase it openly due to the king's frustration with her spending, the queen supposedly needed Rohan to buy it secretly on her behalf. The cardinal eagerly agreed, purchasing the necklace in February 1785 and giving it to La Motte to deliver to Marie Antoinette. On August 15, 1785, Rohan was summoned to Louis XVI's study, where the king, queen, and Baron de Breteuil confronted him about the necklace. The jeweler Bohmer had informed the court that Rohan purchased the necklace in the queen's name, but Marie Antoinette angrily denied ever wanting the gaudy piece, knowing La Motte, or showing Rohan special favor. When the cardinal produced a letter signed Marie Antoinette of France as proof of royal authorization, the monarchs immediately identified it as a forgery. The signature violated royal protocol, which required only the queen's Christian names. Rohan was publicly arrested in the Hall of Mirrors, managing only to instruct an underling to burn incriminating papers at his palace before being taken to the Bastille. The diamond necklace affair captivated the French public not just for its colorful characters like La Motte, a supposed Valois descendant who had worked as a dressmaker's assistant, and Cagliostro, claiming to be 300 years old, but primarily for the conflict between its two privileged antagonists. The central question: was Rohan guilty of criminal presumption for believing the queen would meet him secretly, or should he be acquitted because such behavior seemed plausible from Marie Antoinette? The Queen's history of unconventional behavior, nocturnal outings, and controversial fashions made Rohan's mistake seem reasonable to many. Her white gold dress, the same style that had caused scandal in Vijay Lebrun's portrait, became central evidence, as LaMotte had deliberately dressed Legoix in this exact costume for the impersonation. On May 31, 1786, the Parlement acquitted Rohan by a narrow margin, 26-23, delivering a crushing defeat to Marie Antoinette. The judges explicitly cited the Queen's reputation for frivolity and indiscretion and her succession of male and female favorites of dubious repute as making Rohan's mistake entirely plausible. The public rejoiced at the verdict, with crowds cheering the judges. As the Comte de Boudinot later observed, the revolution was already present in the minds of those who could contemplate such an insult to the king in the person of his wife. Her fashion choices had become central evidence against her character. The confrontation between clothing and politics intensified after the Estates General's opening procession. The Third Estate deputies boldly challenged hierarchy by placing hats on their heads, a privilege traditionally reserved for nobility. This symbolic act expressed the refusal of France's majority to remain disenfranchised. Throughout summer 1789, revolutionary momentum accelerated, with the Third Estate declaring themselves France's only legitimate legislative body as the Assemblée Nationale. As political tensions mounted, clothing became a powerful medium of revolutionary expression. Supporters of the Third Estate signaled their allegiance by wearing ribbon cockades in their hats or on their clothing. Though revolutionary legend claims the first cockade was a green leaf plucked by journalist Camille Desmoulins, blue and red, the colors of Paris, quickly became the preferred combination. These cocards à la nation deliberately replaced the traditional white Bourbon cockade, challenging royal authority through color, just as Marie Antoinette had once distinguished her Trianon household with special scarlet and white livery. On July 17th, Louis XVI traveled to Paris to face the insurgent populace at the Hôtel de Ville, appearing to the British ambassador more a captive than a king, being led along like a tamed bear. The crowd greeted him not with "Long live the king," but with "Long live the nation." Mayor Jean-Sylvain Bailly presented Louis with a cocarde nationale, which the king fumbled to pin atop his royal white rosette. This symbolic gesture, accepting the same badge worn by thousands of low-born Parisians, visibly dismantled the underpinnings of his power by ceding his God-given difference. While revolutionary fashion swept through France, Marie Antoinette's own earlier sartorial innovations were appropriated and repurposed for revolutionary aims. The fashion journal Le Magasin des Modes Nouvelles featured the bonnet aux trois ordres réunis ou confondus, paired with an unfussy white linen skirt and dark blue, Levite-like overdress, garments that were well-known mainstays of the Queen's Trianon wardrobe. Revolutionary fashion thus reclaimed Marie Antoinette's style innovations for the conquest of liberty, exposing the hypocrisy behind her peasant girl posturing while reallocating her designs to a larger, more deserving demographic. On September 7, 1789, another of Marie Antoinette's signature outfits, the infamous white gull, was reinvented as revolutionary attire when 11 women from Paris appeared at the Assemblée wearing simple white dresses and modest bonnets to donate their jewels to the nation's treasury. Led by sculptor's wife Adelaide Moit, these women were celebrated for their beautiful simplicity that is the mark of virtue, with some accessorizing their understated ensembles with tricolor sashes and cockades. The white dress, once associated with the Queen's vice and disrespect, now symbolized revolutionary virtue and patriotism. Following Marie Antoinette's discovery of the Medea cameo, her captors scrutinized its significance while she continued her defiant mourning attire. After the revolutionaries took her son from her and placed him with Simon, who stripped away his black mourning suit and replaced it with Republican clothing, Marie Antoinette spent July staring through a crack in the tower wall seeking glimpses of her son. In August, she was relocated to the Conciergerie prison with only her tattered mourning gown. Denied replacement clothing and personal items, she enlisted Rosalie Lamerlier to help transform her deteriorating widow's coif into simpler bonnets. Without scissors, she tore thread with her teeth for repairs, while female prison employees occasionally mended her dress. She slept fully dressed in black despite the summer heat, anticipating execution at any moment. Despite her captors' attempts to break her spirit, Marie Antoinette maintained her dignity. She managed to write to Madame Royale requesting lace stockings, a cotton redingote, and an underskirt. Madame Elizabeth fulfilled this request through a sympathetic officer named McConus, sending beautiful batiste chemise, kerchiefs, black silk stockings, a white déshabille, nightcaps, and ribbons. When Marie Antoinette appeared before the Revolutionary Tribunal on October 15th, the prosecution's case prominently featured clothing-related charges: the Sacred Heart fabric, the Medea medallion, the Varennes disguises, white cockades, and even an alleged special dress designed to conceal pistols. Fouquier-Tinville repeatedly referred to her black counsel and shadowy conspiracies, rhetorically connecting her black mourning dress to her supposed criminality. Nevertheless, at 4 in the morning on October 16th, she was convicted as a declared enemy of the French nation and sentenced to immediate execution. In a final blow to her dignity, Republican officials forbade her from wearing her mourning gown to the scaffold, claiming it might incite the people to insult her, though prison staff believed they actually feared the interest that she might inspire as the king's widow. As she prepared to face the guillotine, Marie Antoinette had to find something else to wear. Forbidden to wear her widow's black to the scaffold, Marie Antoinette transformed this final indignity into her most brilliant fashion statement. After drafting a farewell letter to Madame Elizabeth, she shed her ragged black dress and dressed herself in pristine white: plum black shoes, a fresh white underskirt, a clean white chemise, the white déshabille dress sent from the temple, and her prettiest muslin fichu. She even removed the black ribbons from her widow's coif, creating a simple ruffled linen bonnet as colorless as her hair. Pale from blood loss, she became a figure of pure, radiant white. This final ensemble stunned the crowds into silence as she traveled to the guillotine in an open cart. While David sketched her as a haggard crone, most spectators witnessed a modest, bereaved woman whose very mourning clothes had been taken away. Her white attire condensed her entire fashionable past: the color of the fleur-de-lis, of a bride's complexion, of whalebone stays, of costume parties, of powdered heads, of the gall, of diamonds and feathers, of the monarchist cockade, of the Princesse de Lamballe's hair, of martyrdom and eternal life. White, the color of the pages on which her story would be written again and again. Louis XIV once called fashion the mirror of history, yet we modern fashion followers often view style through a glass darkly, forgetting yesterday's trends as quickly as new ones appear. While shopping at Barney's during Christmas 2005, I encountered a window display featuring Marie Antoinette, a mannequin with an enormous powdered pouf, frilly white blouse, fitted gray jacket, and billowing black gauze skirt over 12-foot panniers. The display merged consumerism with hints of her tragic end, a tiny guillotine hanging nearby. Initially entranced by the stylish tableau, I momentarily forgot what I had learned through my research: that for Marie Antoinette, fashion was a high-stakes political game with deadly consequences. Unlike later style icons like Jacqueline Kennedy or Princess Diana, Marie Antoinette lived in an era where the crime of lèse costume was expiated on the scaffold. She helped invent fashion as political warfare, a winner-take-all affair that implicated not just her autonomy, but eventually her life. Throughout her life, Marie Antoinette blurred the lines between remembering and forgetting through fashion, stripped of Austrian clothes at the border, recalling Louis XIV through masculine attire while disavowing her queenly status through accessible styles, and finally wearing white to her execution that both erased and underscored her royal martyrdom. Today's designers like Thayskins and Galliano continue to capture this complexity, creating collections where glamour and gore intertwine, where even in death, the queen remained unforgettably fashionable. The Paris Couture's latest collections paid homage to Marie Antoinette not just through clouds of tulle and lace and feathers that echoed Rose Burton's lavish aesthetic, but also by revealing the darker aspects of her stylish life. John Galliano conjured a world where Marie Antoinette's martyrdom looked stunning, where glamour and gore were inseparable. As the Times magazine noted, with faux blood-splattered hems and wild, haunted looks in models' eyes, Galliano's collection suggested the revolution was in full swing and the poor queen had already lost her head.